This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
I get it if people don't want to read about, like, the adult diapers that you wear after you have a baby. Like, that's totally fine. But let's not pretend that those can't be just as literary as, like, I don't know, you know, Philip Roth's Erection.
I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter. And I'm a writer. Bud. Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. Today we have Julia Fine, who is the author of The Upstairs House and What Should Be Wild, which was shortlisted for the Bram Stoker Superior First Novel Award and the Chicago Review of Books Award. She teaches writing in Chicago, where she lives with her husband and children. Welcome, Julia.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. I loved The Upstairs House so much, and I can't wait to talk about it. What are you going to read to us?
I'm going to read from The Upstairs House because... In my brain, it's going to be book promotion season for the rest of my life.
So. As it should be.
No, I listened to Chris Malcolm Beck last week say, he was like, oh, I've got something brand new that I've never read before. It's like, oh, I'm going to read the same thing I read every time I read my stupid book.
But I've never gotten to hear you read from it. So that's a treat.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so I'm going to read from, it's the second chapter, but there really is not much setup except that The baby is Clara, the husband is Ben, and Solly is the dog.
Okay.
Before the baby was my body getting ready for the baby, a preparation both physical, swollen ankles, leg cramps, nausea, and mental. I worried about everything. What if the fumes from the carpet cleaner in the condo next door came through the vents in our bathroom and poisoned our daughter? What if she was born with some new genetic disorder that they couldn't catch with prenatal tests? What if the dog hated the baby and we had to get rid of the dog? What if the dog attacked the baby while we weren't looking and we had to have the dog put down, and then the neighbors got mad because they all loved Solly and they tried to kick us out of the condo association for being bad parents and bad dog parents, and who would want to live next door to those? They would understand, said Ben, when at 8 months pregnant, I played out this scenario. In the incredibly unlikely event that our dog turns vicious and attacks our newborn, I'm sure that everyone will understand why we had to get rid of her. Solly was splayed out on the floor next to the couch, and he reached down to scratch between her ears. But I don't want to get rid of Solly. Then good thing we don't have to. I feel like you're not taking me seriously. I feel like you're not being serious. My face fell, Ben softened. Everyone has babies, he said, which wasn't true. People have babies all the time. We're in one of the best cities in the world, and we have the best doctors. There's nothing to worry about. None of this was true. If we had stayed in New York or moved to Paris, maybe then at least some of it would be true. But after 15 years away, we'd moved back to Chicago. 40 minutes from Ben's parents, 25 from mine. What are you so scared of? I don't know. If I let myself linger, and I tried very hard not to, I did know. What scared me was the being known, the knowing. This baby would forever be bound to me. How would I hide myself from a part of myself? I knew my own mother in ways that I hoped my daughter would never know me. I pitied my own mother and never wanted to be pitied. I'd seen my mother's C-section scars and her sweat stains, knew the smell that she left in the bathroom. I'd heard her ugly laugh and seen her swear at waitstaff and watched her cry in the dark at our old kitchen table after spilling her fourth glass of wine. Motherhood was not a role I'd envied. It was not a job I wanted, but I didn't not want it either. I didn't actively push it away. We hadn't been trying for a baby. I could have hidden the news from Ben and handled everything discreetly, but I didn't. There was a piece of myself I wanted to cultivate, a version of myself I wanted to be. I could pack sack lunches and bring Gatorade to soccer practice. make trifold science fair projects and polish tiny toenails. I could set aside the dissertation that had started to bore me. Best of all, I barely had to do anything. I could choose without actively choosing. Here was my body letting us know that we could have this thing, this future, if we wanted it. I could make something of myself, a literal second self, a second living, breathing someone who would need me. I suppose it would be nice to be needed. If I went to the clinic, I would bleed. If it was just the pill, just a needle, just a quick anesthetic, I thought I might have done it. But I didn't want to bleed. Bleeding would have been so messy, too obvious a metaphor. I was an academic and I lived in a world of eternal incubation, always one more semester, one more grant. To bleed would have commemorated finality, an active commitment for which I was not dispositionally prepared. So Clara was born. We put her in the car seat and the nurses had to correct the straps, which retrospectively seemed like the beginning. Although maybe it was the balloon that was really the beginning, that the back of the nursery bookshelf cracked when Solly stepped on it while I was putting it together, or my writer's block or the stub cigarettes the workman dropped onto our balcony when patching the roof. You have to put her feet through there, the nurses told us as we readied Clara to leave the recovery room. And Ben's eyes got wide and worried. They fixed it, see, I said. Ben worried that my milk hadn't come in yet. He worried about traffic. He had to go to Houston in a week and his guilt was manifesting as anxiety. He adjusted the blanket that was draped over the car seat. We should have gotten one of those specially made covers. Clara's eyes were open. They were a dark blue that would probably turn brown. She had wispy hair and a little birthmark just above her left eyebrow. She looked very small in the car seat. And because of this, the whole project of parenthood suddenly seemed manageable. Still, we stood in the lobby of the hospital, unwilling to embark. Ben frowned, then laughed, then wiped his eyes. He'd never done as well as me on little sleep. On our honeymoon, he had to spend the whole first full day of jet lag at the hotel with the blinds shut. Okay, yes, okay. Ben slapped his fist into his palm. Okay, we got this. Of course we do, I said. Now get in the car. I'll stop there.
Thank you so much for reading that. There's so many parts in this book that I admire because, like, okay, this is a long way of saying what I'm trying to say, but like, I remember when I read the Golden Compass series and all the horrible things that happened to the main character, I remember thinking like, oh, like you're supposed to allow things to happen to your characters. Like you're supposed to allow like them to make bad decisions and horrible things to happen and for their deepest, darkest thoughts to be shown. Like, oh, like as a writer, you're supposed to allow that to happen. And you, like, this book feels like a continual like step off of a cliff or a step out of the top floor of the upstairs house, we'll say.
Step onto the balcony.
Yeah. And I think one of the moments that sticks out for me the most is obviously when she goes to have a drink and leaves Clara with the babysitter that,
oh my God.
And I'm just going to say this because I assume everyone has read this book because it's been out for months. And if you haven't, you should, because it's wild. I remember thinking like, no, that's not going to happen. No. Oh my God, it happened. And as a reader, I was so like nervous and scared and horrified. And as a writer, I was like, God damn, that is brave. So I just want to hear you talk about those moments where you chose, I guess, overall, the book structure in general and the way that it unfolds, the way that Megan's mental illness unfolds through this relationship with Michael Strange and Margaret Wise Brown.
So the emotional stuff and the Megan, this overall structure of the book, I think I'll talk about sort of as a second part because that actually came later, like not the idea of the haunting, but the actual sort of like how to put the pieces together so that it could work as a novel. But in terms of sort of Megan's descent, I definitely had the turn of the screw in mind and sort of this idea of like the ratcheting up and ratcheting up. And I mean, it's a horror novel, you know, the way that horror works, where you start out with something that feels kind of mundane and then gradually, you know, you're like in the, what is the metaphor that everybody's using? Like the frog in the boiling water. You know, you look up and all of a sudden here you are. And so it just made sense that it would progress this way, that she would get to a point, you know, where she was doing these things. And it, so much of it worked for me in this particular context, the context of having it be like a new mother who is sort of slowly losing her grip on reality. Because I think that like all new moms, regardless of whether or not you have sort of a diagnosable postpartum mood disorder, you sort of lose your grip on reality, especially with your first kid, because you just don't know what is normal and what's not. And you don't know what to expect of your body and of this, you know, little creature who suddenly lives in your house and you're supposed to be awake at all hours to care for. And so it fit to me, it fit really nicely to have sort of these things happening to Megan that she can't understand. And because it is sort of layered on top of this new baby and really no social support, she looks at it and she thinks, okay, my hair is falling out. Like, is that normal? Oh, the babysitter's a ghost. Is that normal? Like, you just can't, you know, that line of like what to expect is so, it sort of, it disappears, you know, of what isn't your reality, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so it worked well to have her have this descent. And I also, it was really important to me too. I'm glad you say the whole thing about like, you know, thinking her darkest thoughts. Like I also really, I wanted that to be, it was important to me that like a new mom who, you know, isn't going to murder her kid, but also isn't necessarily thrilled with new parenthood. Like, I feel like so many moms have these thoughts and dads have these thoughts and parents in general, like these moments of like, I'm allowed to swear, right? Mm-hmm. What the fuck did I just do? You know, like, why did I do this? Why did I blow up my life like this? And it felt like, okay, well, why shouldn't I explore those feelings and let this character really lean into that, and be capable of both like loving her daughter and hating parenthood. Mm-hmm.
Did you always have it in the first person when you were drafting, Julia? Because as I was going back through, that was, I think the thing that really makes the book work is the fact that the postpartum psychosis is revealed to the reader in the first person, that you're getting everything else from the narrator. And there's just such a right there feeling with her as she's discovering kind of the boundaries of her psychosis and the rules or lack of rules as it's proceeding. I was wondering if you had arrived at that immediately or if that was something that you kind of arrived at in editing.
Yeah, it was. So Megan was always in the first person. And I knew that I wanted Margaret Wise Brown and Michael Strange to be part of the story. But part of the reason why we have these like moments in the book where you're in third person, Margaret or Michael's point of view, is because that first person was so intense. And it just was like, it like grinds you down to be, and it's so claustrophobic. And it's like, I need like a minute to step outside of Megan because it really sucks being in her head. But yeah, I knew that it was going to be first person. And I knew the question was, again, like sort of turn of the screw, like, is she going crazy or is she seeing ghosts or is it a little bit of both?
I really loved, I loved how at the end, the climax is when she decides which one she is. And then when, you know, and she steps out of the window. And when she wakes up, she's just her, right? Like, and then sort of we see what unfolds after that. You know, she gets the help that she needs, and then holy shit, it turns out that it starts happening for her daughter. And I just thought like that was such a like clever, but like also important thing, important turn at the end of the book to show, you know, like that these things can be genetic, these things, you know, like it's, and it also made it, it also is sort of, you know, like it made you think at the end, like, well, maybe she really is being haunted.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. Like, I wanted to, and I tried to tread so carefully. I would never want to make it sort of as like a pat explanation of like, oh, well, she's crazy and that's why she's seeing all the, you know, like, I don't know, that felt, it felt so, like I wouldn't want to reduce the experience to that. And like, for me, it kind of is both, like she's both being haunted and she's having a psychotic break. And it had having, yeah, that part at the end was a way to sort of acknowledge that it wasn't, things were not resolved. Things don't just go away because you like take a pill and go to therapy, sadly enough. And having, yeah, that, this idea, I mean, so much of the book too is about sort of the legacy of what, how we pass down the way that we, not just the way we parent, but the way that we sort of interact with the world, how our kids see us and copy us, and how, you know, we take what we see our parents doing, both on the Michael and Margaret and on the sort of Megan and Clara and her mom side. And so that just seemed like a really, a nice way to do it. Yeah, there was no way I was just going to like close the door and leave
no,
it there.
No, and I was so, I was so impressed by that. Like, I hate talking about it like, oh, I'm a writer reading a book, but like, seriously, that's how I felt, was like, oh, oh my God. And there, and that whole like leading up to that moment where, you know that Claire is talking to Margaret, is like, is a letting go on Megan's part. It feels like, you know, like in the, the whole book, she's fighting and fighting and fighting for herself. And like, not even for herself as she was before the baby, but just sort of like just fighting for, to keep her head above water and like be who she is. And I, as a mother, obviously, and I'm sure Alex as a father can relate to that with, you know, with all of us have very small children. And then there's that, like literally a denouement, you know, like there's that sort of like descending road at the end where like, she's getting the help she needs. She's got the medicine, like things are calming down. She's, you know, given up on this. She's given up on that, you know? And I felt like that too is something, I mean, like that parents have to grapple with, right? Like you have to make, it's, you know, like, our parents were always talking about sacrifices, and their parents were talking about sacrifices, and their parents were talking about sacrifices. And it's like, you don't want to call it that, but I don't know. Not to say that like, oh, it was necessary for her family to work. Cause I don't think you're saying that either. I think you're being very specific. Like, these are the choices that Megan has made.
Yeah. To me, there was never going to be, it's funny because I've seen, and this is how on, you know, people on Goodreads or reviewers on, you know, who tag you on Instagram or whatever. And they're like, there's no character development in this book. It's like, well, what do you think character development is? Like a character starting one way and then becoming a whole different person. Like, there just was no world in which Megan was going to have this happen and make the decision she made and like end up, you know, like, I've fought through this and survived and I'm happy now. Like, no, she's always going to be unhappy. She's married to the wrong person. She, you know, had a kid without thinking it through and loves the kid, but sort of also gave up her career for the baby. You know, it's not, there wasn't a situation in which she was going to have like triumphed over all the shit that was the whole book. Right. And it would feel really inauthentic to me if she wasn't kind of depressed and sad at the end still.
Well, and the dissertation that is, you know, interstitial throughout the novel really sets you up for the epilogue in a way. When I first hit the epilogue, it really changed the book for me in such a wonderful way. I was like crushed by it, especially the time jumps within it. I loved it. But really when I thought back, I was like, God, I really didn't see that as a reader in a good way. But then I was thinking more, it's like, well, really the disappointment throughout with the dissertation and Megan's advisor, kind of the interactions with her advisor were saying like, this isn't going to work. Or, you know, I don't really know what you're going for here. It really sets up what's to come in other aspects of her life. I feel like it was really the dissertation was kind of crushing in that way too, because as writers, you know, you're reading it and you're thinking, I have some sense of what it takes to write this dissertation, you know, having written books. And it's just the fact that that project is not truly going to come to fruition. It's just, and yet is in this complete novel, was such an interesting move.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because the dissertation, it began as a way to be able to write about Margaret and Michael, because I sort of I was writing already a sort of like horror psychological thriller postpartum book about new parenthood. And then I sort of encountered all this history about Margaret Wise Brown. And I was like, how do I jam these things together that I'm interested in? And the dissertation sort of began as a way to just provide the reader. At first it was going to be like, you know, Megan knows about this because she's writing a dissertation. And then I was like, oh no, it's so much easier to just be like, here's the dissertation. And I don't have to use, you know, like the exposition, the problem of exposition is solved. But it became, as I kept going too, such a way to show where she was mentally and sort of where, how the ghosts, however you want to view them, had come into her everyday life, and how like her work was haunted by, you know, this past self and these women. And it was, I mean, it was a lot of fun to write the dissertation, both in its sort of generic form and then as it got like weirder and haunted.
Oh, I bet. I mean, it's so rich. I cannot believe how rich that Kurt Weiss Brown and Michael Strange's lives were.
Oh my God. I know.
Unbelievable.
It's wild. I felt when I first read Margaret's biography, I thought like, how is it possible that we haven't had like the prestige miniseries?
And
nobody has written this, not necessarily this particular novel, but like, why isn't this story out there? And it's like, oh, I better write this book quickly so that somebody doesn't jump on it before me.
I mean,
now,
she's like,
are you writing that screenplay?
There you go.
Maybe somebody else will write that screenplay someday. Yeah. No, I don't know about you, but I'm not going to write a screenplay probably ever. I know people do it, but I think like everything I love about writing books, you lose when you write a screenplay.
I'll do anything for money. So,
you know, whatever. Well, Alex, you should write the screenplay.
Yeah, sure. There you go.
Get right on that, Alex.
I mean, didn't in the book, didn't it say that she basically created board books?
Yeah, she did.
That blew my mind. I was like, how did I not know that? That's unbelievable.
I know. It's so wild to think about. I mean, you can sort of see it now. Like, I read books to my kids where you're like, oh, I loved this book as a child. Like, Curious George. You're like, oh, mm-hmm. I loved this as a child. Like, oh, they put a bag over his head and like take him out. You know, there's all these things where you're like, this is just not appropriate. So you see how the field has changed, right? Like, mm-hmm. just by naturally looking at what you did as a kid. But when you think too about like what our grandparents had access to, like they just didn't have books for kids. Like, they just didn't exist. Like, that type of book for like, you know, 18-month-old. And so, yeah, Margaret Wise Brown and her mentor, Lucy Sprague Mitchell, who was the founder of the Bank Street School for Children. It was like a progressive early education laboratory, basically. You know, they would study kids and then use what they saw in their teaching techniques. And they basically were like, oh no, kids need books that are not just like kids. I guess really it is like, you know, kids are not just miniature adults. Like, kids have their own developmental needs. And so therefore you shouldn't just read them, you know, books that are slightly toned down versions of what adults would like. You should provide them actually something that they can respond to. And so these, all the books that our kids read of like, you know, the fire truck goes beep, 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 or like, here is the blue sky. Like, that all didn't exist until they were like, oh, this is how these children think. And this is how they should read. And Margaret Wise Brown took it a step further and was like, well, also babies put things in their mouths. So why don't we have books that they can put in their mouths and touch and play with and, you know, really interact with. And so she, yeah, like all sorts of like the tactile books she started, and Lucy Sprague Mitchell did those. I'm not sure if growing up you read those. You know, I was a pioneer in the wagon train and this is my story. Like, they invented those types of books for older kids too. It all, yeah, it, and this was just like 1940s, like not that long ago.
Jeez.
I, like, my kids, all three of them were obsessed with Goodnight Moon at certain points in their lives. And I just always assumed that Margaret Wise Brown looked like the grandma bunny in the chair.
Yeah, she's like a hot, you know,
a babe.
And
that book is so eerie.
So fucking weird.
And it's cozy. So weird. Like, it's so,
I know,
cozy.
I love it.
But it's also like, they're like, I remember, I think Emma Straub wrote about it at some point, maybe when her kids were much littler, about how like, you're up as high as the moon. Like, the moon is right there in the window. Mm-hmm. Like, there's that good night nobody part.
Oh yeah, that was, yeah, that's, I mean, that's like why this book exists, because it was like, why the fuck is that bad?
yes And like, someone just, maybe you posted about this, Julia, just wrote about how no one says goodbye or goodnight telephone. It's from the
I did see that was I cannot remember who wrote it. I think it was a McSweeney's, maybe.
I think it was something like that.
But no, it is, it doesn't follow. One of the reasons it's so great is like you expect a book like that, like they introduce all of these objects and then you say goodnight to all of the objects. But then you like, well, you don't even meet the telephone, or I guess you do. Anyway, regardless of what you do with the telephone, then you suddenly are like, we're outside of the room. Oh, goodnight stars, goodnight air, goodnight, yeah. You know, and it doesn't follow, you know, like you expect it to sort of have the structure that it then eschews. And so it, I don't know, maybe that's why I love it. Also, I love that it doesn't rhyme, or that it rhymes moon with moon. There's so many good things about
The colors are great.
Yeah.
I mean, orange and green. It's like, how often do you encounter that? So, I don't know.
And it all gets darker as you go, which is something that I didn't really notice my first 100 million reads. But it was, so you, the illustrator, so Margaret had worked with Clement Hurd before on Runaway Bunny, and like they were good friends, and they did, you know, his wife was really good friends with Margaret. And so she just wrote a letter to him of like the instructions of what she wanted it to look like. And it was like a little boy bunny in bed saying goodnight to things, and the room gets darker and darker.
And then he's asleep at the end. That's like so
crazy. That's the unbelievable part.
Yeah, I know, right? And the grandma's not there, like the rocking chair's empty and the bunny's asleep. It's like,
yeah.
That's how it's supposed to go.
Oh, if only.
Oh, God.
I still think about this book all the time as I'm writing, like to give myself the courage.
Thank you.
But you mentioned something on Twitter at some point where you said 5 years ago when I started writing The Upstairs House, maybe, I don't know if you said exactly 5 years ago, but there weren't books like this. And now people are all talking about how there's
too many. Yeah. This is the year of the like postpartum new mom horror, I guess,
or
new parent surrealist books.
Yeah. Do you agree that there's too many?
Oh, there's definitely not too many.
That's what I was going to say.
No, definitely not. Also, like it's funny though. So The Need by Helen Phillips. I don't know if you've read that.
Oh, yes, I have. Yep.
I feel like it could be like cousins with The Upstairs House. It's funny because when you read the descriptions of them, they feel very similar. And so when I first saw that book was coming out, and I don't know if I'd already sold this one, or I was like trying to sell this one, and I was like, oh, well, there's my book, you know, but they're so different. So that book is about a woman who has, I think she has like a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old, and there's like another version of herself basically, who's like trying to break into their house. I don't know. It's crazy. Yeah, like it's wonderful.
Something horrible happens.
Oh, it's much more, I hesitate to say sci-fi because I don't really know what I'm talking about, but it feels much more.
It is speculative.
It's speculative in a different way than Upstairs House is. But anyway, so I saw like, oh, that book is coming out. Is there room for my book? Or like Rachel Yoder's Night Bitch, which is about a mom who like turns into a dog. And that one too, again, like you read it and you're like, well, these aren't really similar, but people are like, oh, you know, this is the genre, you know? But it just makes me feel like, okay, well, these books are all, you know, they're about parenthood, but they're all so different. Mm-hmm. Like, do you say like, oh no, another coming of age story, another love story, you know, like, come on. You know, people just have this idea. I get it if people don't want to read about like the adult diapers that you wear after you have a baby, like that's totally fine, but let's not pretend that those can't be just as literary as like, I don't know, you know, Philip Roth's Erection. It just feels like, it feels like there's a certain thing, like, you know, certain types of bodily experiences and gendered emotional experiences are allowed, and you can say like, this is literary, this is high quality literature, and then, you know, like, oh no, we have more than one book about a nursing mother, how could you publishers, how could you, like, it's just such a weird, annoying,
it's so annoying
social thing.
It's such a gendered response too, because you think about the amount of books that, like, if you use Philip Roth as an example, and it's so true, and there's so many authors who have written about so many, you know, old man, annoying, still wants to have sex with a young woman books. There's millions of these. And the fact that there's like this perceived cap on how many postpartum book, young mother postpartum books. It's like, it's insane. It's baffling.
Oh my God. And it's also funny too, when people are like, oh, it, you know, too many. So what, like three?
Exactly. Right. Right. You just named three books, right? You named three or four books. Yeah. It's crazy.
No, it does. It's just like, it also is a lesson, I think, to like the wider world, which is probably not anyone who listens to your podcast and never knows how long, like how long a game publishing a book is. Mm-hmm. But like people act as if it's like when COVID hit and the books that were coming out in like last July, people were like, well, it's weird that they say it's 2021, but no one's wearing a mask. Like, you know, like, okay, idiot. sorry, I'm being so mean. If there are a lot of books coming out this year that are about how difficult it is to be a new parent or how hard it is to be specifically a mother of young children, like maybe that's a sign that as a society, we're doing a terrible job helping mothers of young children. You know, like it's not like we all got together and we're like, let's publish books. You know, I think a lot of people have this experience and felt like, for me, at least I had, I felt very lonely as a new mom. And obviously I didn't have, you know, the experience that Megan has. Although weirdly enough, she did live in a combination of the two condos I lived in while writing this book. I felt like I had not really seen anyone say it's okay to have this resentment and it's okay to like not to be unhappy, you know, and it's okay. Even like, it's okay to have postpartum depression and it's mm-hmm. not, you know, you don't have to feel guilty about it and you don't have to feel guilty about those moments where you wish that you had your old life back. And so that was sort of my one of the reasons why sort of it was important to me to write this particular book. And I think in these other books, I feel like what I am also seeing and hearing are things like that, where like, oh, you don't have to love, you know, chopping up grapes and like cutting crusts off of peanut butter sandwiches. And like, you're not a bad person because you just want your kid to like stop touching you for 20 seconds.
Oh my God.
You know? So like, I don't know. I'm thrilled that they're out there.
Yeah.
There's always that like elderly woman around the corner going, don't wish it away. Enjoy it. You know? And it's like, and you know, like, and I can, some lady just told me, I was like walking along smiling with my children and she still stopped us and was like, you need to make sure you enjoy these moments because blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I know. I was like, literally smiling outdoors with my children. But you also totally understand where they're coming from because she's like, you know, she was saying her kids mm-hmm. are in their 30s and she would, you know, kill to have them that little again. And it's like, I know that so inherently inside me, I know it, but
you can know both things. Like you can have both things. Like it can be really, really great to have a new baby. And it can also be terrible at the same time, because mm-hmm. like, that's just how life is, you know, mm-hmm. like that's maybe not how like America in 2021 is, where we're all, right. you know, everything is just, you know, black and white, polarized,
fucked.
Who even knows? Mm-hmm. But like in actual life, like as a human being experiencing the world, like there are very few things that are pure joy or pure sort of disgust or pain or anything. And like an experience as nuanced as like bringing a baby into the world and caring for it or raising a child, like of course you're going to have both.
My dad always, or my dad, he didn't always say this. He said this to me once and it stuck with me. He said, as a parent, you're lucky if you come out of it and you break even. And I didn't understand what he meant. I thought, because my dad was a banker and he's like very into numbers and stuff. So I was like, is he talking about like how much we cost? But I realized it's like, there's going to be a lot of shit and like, mm-hmm. and a lot of fear and rage and like boredom. But yeah. you're also like, if you can break even with all the good stuff, then you're doing okay.
I like that. I like that a lot.
I like it. And it's also sad.
Yeah, it is. But it's just true.
It's true. It's true. And it is, it really is something to strive for. It's like, if I can break even, if mm-hmm. like the good is the same amount as the bad, then that's good.
I'm just someone who I just don't want to be told, like you said, like someone telling me to enjoy it or be happy or to be like, if you tell me to enjoy it, that's a sign that I'm not going to enjoy it. Like, yeah. I don't know what it is. If you tell me, like, make sure you savor this, like, okay, well, here I'm going to be wishing I was doing something else. But it's like those little moments where, you know, I don't know. It's those unexpected things that are like nice about having a kid. That,
and it also, like, whenever I read something like your book, and I see myself in it, it broadens it for me. It makes it mm-hmm. more, it makes it like better. It makes the experience deeper. It makes it, because you feel less alone
yeah.
and you feel like, you know, like, and that's what, like, not pushing it down and denying that it exists. Like, that's not, mm-hmm. it's when you see yourself in a book and you, you know, you recognize, you know, those dark, that darkness. And then it just sort of like, you share the darkness a little and it makes it less dark. I don't know.
Yes, it's exactly.
important. Exactly. It's so much better than going to the doctor and having to fill out that goddamn survey. Like, oh, do I laugh as much as I used to? No, I don't. Yeah. But I also don't want you to talk to me about it.
Are you sleeping well with your 6-week-old?
Yeah. It's like, do you feel as much hope as you did before? And it's like, do you know what year it is?
Oh my God. I know. So my daughter too was born. She's actually turns one on Tuesday. So she's a pandemic baby. And
oh my gosh.
And so like all of it, I was like, okay, like, let's not even pretend right now.
Yeah. Yes. And it's like, they don't really want to know the answer. Like, I've cried in plenty of doctor's offices when things have been bad and they're just kind of like, well, just keep holding on, you know,
check the box. Yeah.
Yeah. Alex has a pandemic baby too. She turns one next month, right?
July 6th.
Oh, yeah. June 29th. So there they're basically the same.
Yeah.
When Megan is watching HGTV in this book, what
already funny?
What do you picture? And also, I just need like your personal ranking of HGTV shows so we can go back and forth on this.
It's definitely Property Brothers.
Oh, Prop Bros 1?
Hey.
No, that's not my ranking. That's what Megan is watching.
Okay, got it.
What's the one? I have not watched HGTV, honestly, like since my son was nursing constantly. But that is what we had on all the time.
Sure.
What's the one with Chip and Joanna? See,
what is that one?
Fixer Upper.
Hell yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Fixer Upper, I think, is my number one, although I don't know what it's called. My mother-in-law is a big HGTV, not just watcher, but like prop project completer.
Okay,
so like she watches it with an eye for like, I'm gonna do this in my house, whereas I watch it with like, get me through the day. You know. And so she's the one who I think turned me on to it. What's the other one? My number one, which is not HGTV but is could be on, is what's the housewives, real estate housewives ladies?
Oh,
what's that one called?
Oh my
Wait,
God.
What,
which one? Selling Sunset.
Oh, yeah,
I haven't seen that one.
Oh my God, Lindsay. That's my number one. I don't watch. So this is really, I don't really watch TV anymore because I'm trying to write a book. And also I have two kids that I care for full time.
Right.
The thing that has gone is my, you know, I don't even want to say guilty pleasure, my genuine pleasure television. Mm-hmm. So I'm like so behind on New York Housewives and I'm so behind on basically everything. Like The Bachelor, I'm probably just never going to watch again because it's, you just have to dedicate your life to it.
Why are they so long? Why is every episode so
I know.
Long?
And also
so boring.
Also boring. Yeah. Long and boring. And yet for 15 years, that's what I did.
It has been on a long time.
I am not right now. Like my schedule right now is insane. I write from whenever my daughter goes to sleep, my husband does. So my daughter is almost one and my son is four. And I'll do sort of like the beginning of his bedtime routine. And then daddy handles the, like, I need water, I have to pee, I need another book, lie on the floor with me. that kind of thing. Like, so Rick will do that. And I just like make sure the baby is settled. And then I will write. We either eat with the kids at 5 o'clock or we just sort of eat our own separate dinners. And I have tried, I'm trying to, you know, just write until 9:30 and then we'll maybe watch like a 20-minute episode of something. Mm-hmm. And then that's it. So there's no time for the good stuff, but the night writing thing is definitely new. in the past like few months. And I think that everything I've written is really awful, but I haven't reread any of it. I'm just like trying to power through a draft. And so it could be that like, this is a book that I can work with on the back end, or I could just be like drinking wine in like some weird fever dream of words that aren't even forming sentences.
That's
and I
exactly
just don't know
how I described it. I know, because I've been waking up at 5 to write and I write, I have like a word count goal that I meet. And so like, if I meet it before 6 a.m. when my kids start making moves, then I'll like try to go back to sleep. And if not, then I just like, you know, try to get it done. But I too have like not gone back and read it. And I really do worry, like in my head, I'm like, okay, I think it's like holding together, but I worry I'm going to go back and be like, what the hell?
Oh, I mean, I'm absolutely sure that there are like, occasionally I'll like look back at it and I'm like, ooh, missing like 7 words. Like what? This sentence doesn't make sense, but I think structurally maybe it works. I don't know. This is the advice that I've always given my students too, because is that you can't really, you're wasting your time if you're writing a novel and you are editing and editing and rewriting like the first 20 pages, which is what I did for my, you know, the first several books that I wrote, and definitely the first one that I sold. You know, it just is like, well, why are you doing that? You're gonna have to change it when you get to the end anyway. And so I've told my students for years that they should just be doing what I'm currently doing. And I never did it myself until now. So we'll see what happens.
Go.
We'll see. I don't know. There's something about having like a full draft though, where you feel like, okay, I at least it's not like I'm pretending to write a book. I don't know. This such a weird, I mean, this, what this whole podcast is about is like that weird feeling of, you know, if I don't currently have a book in the pipeline, am I a writer? You know,
I know it really is. It's like, it's the hustle never fucking ends, you know, like if you're not hustling. What I worry about is like, okay, like generating the words is one thing, and it requires this like certain part of your brain and your heart and soul, but going back through and revising, I don't think I can do that at 5 a.m.
No. Oh my God. Yeah. This is my plan right now, is to spend the summer drafting. And then my son is, thank the Lord, finally going to be in school. And hopefully my daughter will nap, and like, maybe we'll get a babysitter and I'll have like actual time. Yeah. There's no way that anything, you know, like occasionally maybe there's like that weird id, like in flow semi-brilliance that can come out of you when you're just like pushing it out. But no, for editing, you need your brain.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. I need to not be like, oh my God, do I hear one of them getting out of their beds? What are they doing? Are they going to pee? Are they going to go back to bed after they're done peeing?
So this is why I started at night, because like the one time that I know that both my kids are occupied with sleep, and will not demand a snack, right when they go to bed. Because if it's later at night, somebody might wake up. Mm-hmm. And if it is during nap time has progressed, this is so awful. Again, this is why, you know, don't take my parenting advice. my son, I was telling Lindsay before, my son is a 4:45 in the morning kind of guy. He's just up and ready for the day. It doesn't really matter what. And so he napped until about 3:30. And we said, oh, if we get rid of this nap, which is when I had been working for his entire life, and my daughter was finally sort of like lining up and it was going to be great, you know, if we get rid of that nap, maybe he'll sleep and we'll be able to sleep in the morning. Oh, and God. What has happened is now he has an hour of TV and snacks where he sits on the iPad saying, another snack, mommy, I need a snack, mommy.
Can't relate
so
at
I
all.
Can't get anything done then either. So that's like emails and like lesson planning and sort of, you know, work that isn't writing work time, but like, no, I don't know how people write. People who are like, oh, just put cartoons on and you can write while they watch TV, sit next to them. Like, no.
If my kids, if I'm within their eyesight, I got to be up. If I sit down, that's like a no for them.
No. And if you're not paying attention to what they're watching on TV, or like, mommy, why aren't you watching me as
mommy,
I'm
watch
coloring
this, watch
my
this.
Crayons?
You know, watch this, watch this. Yes. Yeah. Oh God, the watch this.
Yes. I must have all your attention all the time.
And it's like, I am literally right next to you. I have published 4 books in my life. I've written many more than that. I have, you know, a beautiful family and home, great marriage, but my biggest accomplishment in life was the summer that Judith was born. And I had 3 children at home with me all summer long. I put them down for naps at the same time every day.
Wow.
And I feel like no one can ever take that from me. And they all slept.
I don't even try it because it makes me want to die.
We do a lot of the car. So lately, so this is again, like a perk of the fact that my husband has been working from home for over a year now, is that if the baby falls asleep in the car, what I have done the past few times is he takes the older one inside and he can be the snack giver. And he can bring me my laptop and I just sit in the car with the sleeping mm-hmm. baby and I've tried mm-hmm. to work. And that actually has been, it's actually almost better because I don't have access to the internet.
Yep.
Mm.
So yeah, I mean, long term, none of these are solutions.
No, I know.
Honestly, if somebody else can be the snack giver, like that is my least favorite part of the day. It's like right when you get into whatever it is you're trying to do, and all of a sudden, like, just get your own snacks, child. Or actually, the real solution is like eat your lunch.
Yes,
please
for real.
Eat your lunch. Oh my
eat
god,
the meals. Eat your lunch. You won't be so hungry. Eat what I've made lunch. You.
I know. It's like good. It's stuff you like. Eat it.
I know. And the worst is when you're like, okay, what do you want for dinner? I'm going to make you this, this, or this. And they tell you, and then you give it to them and they're like, nah.
No.
It's like, I'm going to kill all of you.
Oh my God.
Yeah. We had that tonight. Mommy, I don't like this. Please don't make it again. Like, okay, well, you asked for it. You picked it out.
My middle child wants box mac and cheese for every meal. And so it's like when I have to bring him his meal that isn't the mac and cheese, I'm always like, okay, is this fine? Well, Julia, do you want to tell us anything about what the book is about that you're writing?
I can talk a little about it, I think. So it is, again, this is just like proving myself to be an absolute crazy person because it's about, Vivaldi, the composer.
Okay, I'm in.
Is, again, a weird place to start. he taught music and composed a lot of his pieces, not the Four Seasons, which is what everyone knows, but like a lot of his other stuff. He taught at this basically like an orphanage for young girls in Venice. The book began as like maybe writing about Vivaldi, but now what it is actually about is just two girls who are a violinist and a singer in Venice in 1720 who... How do I even describe it? I've been saying it. I pitched it to my agent as like, it's like the Olivia Rodrigo Sour album in Vivaldi's Venice with like a sea monster.
That's a great pitch. That's a really good pitch.
it's about like how teenage girls are awful to each other, but still kind of love each other. And there's also sort of like a Faustian sort of bargain. And it's also just me like having fun writing about music, and Venice is really cool. But the reason I'm crazy is I don't play violin. I've never been to Venice. Like, why?
Oh my goodness.
Obviously, I don't live in the 18th century. Do you want more work? Like, just making work for myself, right and left. But I'm into it. It's been a lot of fun. And hopefully my agent will have a better way to pitch it.
I don't know. Your way was pretty good.
I want to read that book.
Yeah.
And I think the good thing about that is like, when you're sick of writing or you don't have anything to say, you can be like, well, I'm writing because I'm researching Venice right now. Like I'm going to open up some Google tabs.
I also have, we've done a lot of like YouTube. Oh, the other thing too. So like when snack nap time, my kid who like, I wish I had a kid you could put in front of the TV and he would just watch TV, but instead he needs snacks and then like me to be with him. So it's like, okay, we're going to sit and do this like YouTube walking tour of Venice. And I'm going to tell you that you're in Venice. And he's like, oh, we're going to this restaurant right now. Oh, look, mommy, we're going on the boat. And it's like, okay, this is like educational for both of us. You know?
There you go. See,
but you can participate with me.
That is such a classic. I'm a writer, but moment. Just like I'm being a mother, but I'm also doing.
Come do this with me. Oh, I also have bought him like a book called like Welcome to the Orchestra and like all these things. My kid has like the weirdest. I think this is just the case probably for all writers' kids though, where they just, it's a combination. Like some people are like, yeah, I'm inspired by my kid is interested in this thing. And so my book is about this thing. And like, that actually is true because there's trash trucks in the upstairs house. But also like, I'm like, these are my weird interests. Kids, you're going to be into it with me.
Oh, totally.
Oh, but no, the garbage truck is like totally because my kid was obsessed with garbage trucks. And I was like, what can happen in this scene? Better bring a trash truck in.
Such a thing. God, yeah. The garbage truck is like, Yeah, it's like the highlight of the week sometimes.
Yeah, we follow it from corner to corner. What a life. Okay, well, it is nearing your writing time, Julia, so we're going to let you go.
All right. Well, this has been so fun.
Yeah,
this,
thank you.
This is awesome. I was so looking forward to talking to you. And
this is like the highlight of my weekend.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Everybody read The Upstairs House. It is wild and terrifying and just so great. Okay.
Okay, Lindsay Hunter.
Yeah. I got nothing.
Yeah, I got nothing. I'll see you in 2 days.
Okay. Wait, what? Oh, yeah, you're coming over.
3 days? 2 days? 3 days?
No, you're right. It's Tuesday, right? Tuesday morning?
I don't know. You told me a day. I put it on my phone. And then
yeah, you'll be there. You'll be there. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Go watch Skyfall.
Oh, I will.
Okay.
Okay, bye.
Bye. I'm a Writer But is recorded by Alex Higley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop. Yeah, yeah!